and a little locket with his mother's picture inside it. Flagg opened the engraved box and very carefully shredded one corner of the packet's flap. Now it looked as if a mouse had been chewing at it. Flagg closed the lid again and put the box in the recessed space.
"You cried so when you lost this box, dear Peter,"
he murmured.
"I think you may cry even more when it's found."
He giggled. He put the sleeping mouse beside the box, closed the compartment, and put the books neatly back in place. Then he left and slept well. Great mischief was afoot, and he felt confident that he had moved as he liked to move, behind the scenes, seen by no one. For the next 3 days, King Roland seemed healthier, more vigorous, and more decisive than anyone had seen him in years, it was the talk of the court. Visiting his ill and feverish brother in his apartments, Peter remarked to Thomas in awe that what remained of their father's hair actually seemed to be changing color, from the baby-fine wispy white it had been for the last 4 years or so to the iron gray it had been in Roland's middle years. Thomas smiled, but a fresh chill raced through him. He asked Peter for another blanket, but it wasn't really a blanket he needed. He needed to unsee that final strange toast, and that, of course, was impossible. Then, after dinner on the third day, Roland complained of indigestion. Flagg offered to have the court physician summoned. Roland waved the suggestion away, saying that he felt fine, actually, better than he had in months, in years. He belched. It was a long, arid, rattling sound. The convivial crowd in the ballroom fell silent with wonder and apprehension as the king doubled over. The musicians in the corner ceased playing. When Roland straightened up, a gasp ran through those present. The king's cheeks were aflame with color. Smoking tears ran from his eyes. More smoke drifted from his mouth. There were perhaps 70 people in that great dining hall. Rough-dressed riders, what we would call knights, I suppose. Sleek courtiers and their ladies, attendants upon the throne, courtesans, jesters, musicians, a little troop of actors in one corner who had been going to put a play on later, servants in great numbers. But it was Peter who ran to his father. It was Peter they all saw going to the doomed man, and this did not displease Flagg at all. Peter, they would remember it had been Peter. Roland clutched his stomach with one hand and his chest with the other. Smoke suddenly poured out of his mouth in a gray-white plume. It was as if the king had learned some amazing new way of telling the story of his greatest exploit. But it was no trick, and there were screams as smoke poured not only from his mouth, but from his nostrils, ears, and the corners of his eyes. His throat was so red it was nearly purple.
"Dragon!"
King Roland shrieked as he collapsed into his son's arms.
"Dragon!"
It was the last word he ever spoke. 32. The old man was tough, incredibly tough. Before he died, he was throwing off so much heat that no one, not even his most loyal servants, could approach closer to his bed than 4 feet. Several times they threw buckets of water on the poor dying king when they saw the bedclothes beginning to smolder. Each time the water turned instantly to steam that billowed through his bedchamber and out into the sitting room, where courtiers and riders stood in numb silence and ladies clustered, weeping and wringing their hands. Just before midnight a jet of green flame shot from his mouth, and he died. Flagg went solemnly to the door between the bedchamber and the sitting room and announced the news. There followed an utter silence that stretched out for more than a minute. It was broken by a single word which came from somewhere in the gathered crowd. Flagg did not know who spoke that one word, and he did not care. It was enough that it had been spoken. Indeed, he would have bribed a man to speak it if such could have been done with no danger to him. "Murder," this someone said. There was a universal gasp. Flagg raised a solemn hand to his mouth to hide a smile. 33. The court physician amplified one word to 3, murder by poison. He did not say murder by dragon sand, for the poison was unknown in Delane, except to Flagg. The king died shortly before midnight, but by dawn the charge was rife in the city and spreading outward toward the far reaches of the eastern, western, southern, and northern baronies. Murder. Regicide. Roland the Good dead by poison. Even before then, Flagg had organized a search of the castle from the highest point, the eastern tower, to the lowest, the dungeon of Inquisition with its racks and manacles and squeezing boots. Any evidence bearing on this terrible crime, he said, must be searched out and reported at once. The castle rang with the search. 600 grimly eager men combed through it. Only two small areas of the castle were exempt. These were the apartments of the two princes, Peter and Thomas. Thomas was barely aware of this. His fever had worsened to the point where the court physician had become deeply alarmed. He lay in a delirium as dawn's first light fingered its way into his windows. In his dreams he saw two glasses of wine raised high, heard his father say again and again, "Did you spice it? It tasted mulled." Flagg had ordered the search, but by 2 in the morning, Peter had recovered enough of his wits to take charge of it. Flagg let him. These next few hours would be terribly important, a time when all could be won or lost, and Flagg knew it. The king was dead. The kingdom was momentarily headless, but not for long. This very day, Peter would be crowned king at the foot of the needle, unless the crime was brought home to the boy quickly and conclusively. Under other circumstances, Flagg knew, Peter would have been under suspicion at once. People always suspect those who have the most to gain, and Peter had gained a great deal by his father's death. Poison was horrible, but poison might have won him a kingdom. But in this case the people of the kingdom spoke of the boy's loss rather than the boy's gain. Of course, Thomas had lost his father too, they might add after a pause, almost as if they were ashamed of the momentary lapse. But Thomas was a sullen, sulky, awkward boy who had often argued with his father. Peter's affection and respect for Roland, on the other hand, were known far and wide. And why, people would ask, if the monstrous idea was even raised, and so far it had not been, why would Peter kill his father for the crown when he would surely inherit it in a year or 3 or 5? If evidence of the crime were to be found in a secret place that only Peter knew, however, a place in the prince's own rooms, the tide would turn quickly. People would begin to see a murderer's face beneath a mask of affection and respect. They would point out that to the young a year may seem like 3, 3 like 9, 5 like 25. Then they would point out that the king had seemed, in the last few days of his life, to be coming out of a long, dark time, had seemed to be growing hale and vigorous again. Perhaps, they would say, Peter had believed his father was entering a long, healthy Indian summer, had panicked and done something as foolish as it was monstrous. Flagg knew something else. He knew that people have a deep and instinctive distrust of all kings and princes, for these are people who may order their deaths with a single nod, and for crimes as petty as dropping a handkerchief in their presence. Great kings are loved. Lesser kings are tolerated. Kings to be represent a scary, unknown quantity. They might come to love Peter if given a chance, but Flagg knew they would also condemn him quickly if shown enough evidence. Flagg thought such evidence would be forthcoming soon. Nothing more than a mouse. Small, but big enough in its way to shake a kingdom to its foundations. XXXIV. In Delane there were only 3 stages of being: childhood, half-manhood or womanhood, and adulthood. These half-years lasted from 14 to 18. When Peter entered half-manhood, the scolding nannies were replaced with Brandon, his butler, and Dennis, Brandon's son. Brandon would be Peter's butler for years yet, but probably not forever. Peter was very young, and Brandon was nearing 50. When Brandon was no longer able to buttle, Dennis would take over. Brandon's family had buttled high royalty for nearly 800 years and were justifiably proud of the fact. Dennis rose each morning at 5 o'clock, dressed, laid out his father's suit, and shined his father's shoes. Then he wandered blearily into the kitchen and ate breakfast. At 5:45, he set out from the family's home on the west side of the castle keep and entered the castle proper by the lesser west door. Promptly at 6 o'clock he would reach Peter's rooms, let himself quietly in, and go about the early chores, building a fire, making 6 breakfast muffins, heating water for tea. Then he would quickly circle the three rooms, setting them to rights. This was usually easy because Peter was not a messy boy. Last of all, he would return to the study and lay out breakfast, for the study was where Peter liked to eat the meals he took in his rooms, usually at his desk by the east windows with a history book open before him. Dennis didn't like getting up early, but he liked his job very much, and he liked Peter, who was always patient with him even when he made a mistake. The only time he had ever raised his voice to Dennis was when Dennis had brought him a light lunch and had neglected to put a napkin on the tray.
"I'm very sorry, Highness," Dennis had said on that occasion. "I just never thought—"
"Well, next time do think," Peter said. He was not shouting, but it was a close thing. Dennis had never neglected to put a napkin on Peter's tray again, and sometimes, just to be safe, he put on two. Morning chores done, Dennis faded into the background, and his father took over. Brandon was every bit the perfect butler, with his cravat neatly knotted, his hair pulled tightly back and rolled in a bun at the nape of his neck, his coat and breeches without a speck, his shoes shined to a mirror gloss Dennis was responsible for. But at night, with his shoes off, his coat hung in the closet, his cravat loosened and a glass of bundle gin in his hand, he looked to Dennis a much more natural man.
"Tell you something to always be remembrant, Denny," he had said to his son on many occasions while in this comfortable state. "There may be as many as a dozen things in this world which last, but surely no more, and may be less. Passionate love of a woman don't last, and a runner's wind don't last, nor does a braggart's wind, nor does hay time in the summer or sugar time in spring thaw. But two things that do last is one, royalty, and another, service. If you stick with your young man until he's an old man, and if you take care of him proper, he'll take care of you proper. You serve him, and he'll serve you, if you take the turn of my mind. Now pour me another glass and take a drop for yourself, if you like, but no more than a drop or your mother'll skin us both alive."
Undoubtedly some sons would quickly have grown bored with this catechism, but Dennis did not. He was the rarest of sons, a boy who had reached 20 and still thought his father wiser than himself. On the morning after the king's death, Dennis hadn't had to force himself blearily out of bed at 5 o'clock. He had been awakened at 3 by his father with the news of the king's death.
"Flags reared up a search party,"
his father said, eyes full of bloodshot distress.
"And that's right enough. But my master will be leading it soon enough, I'll warrant, and I'm off to help him hunt for the fiend who done it if he'll have me."
"Me too,"
Dennis cried, grabbing for his breeches.
"Not at all, not at all,"
his father said with a hard sternness that made Dennis subside at once.
"Things will go forward here just as they always have, murder or no. The old ways must be kept to now more than ever. My master and your master will be crowned king at noon, and that's well enough, although he comes to the crown in a bad time. But the death of a king by violence is always an evil thing if it comes not on the field of battle. The old ways will hold, doubt it not, but there may be trouble in the meantime. What's best for you, Dennis, is to go about your work just the same as always."
He was gone before Dennis could protest, and when 5 o'clock came, Dennis told his mother what his father had said and told her he should get about his morning round, even though he knew Peter would be gone. Dennis's mother was more than agreeable. She was dying for news. She told him to go, of course. Go and then come back to her no later than 8 of the clock and tell her all he heard. So Dennis went to Peter's rooms, which were utterly deserted. Nevertheless, he observed his regular routine, finishing by setting breakfast in the prince's study. He looked ruefully at the plates and glasses, the jams and jellies, reflecting that surely none of those things would be used that morning. Still, going about his ordered course had made him feel better for the first time since his father had turned him out of bed, for he now understood that, for better or worse, things were never going to be the same again. Times had changed. He was preparing to leave when he heard a sound. It was so muffled he couldn't rightly tell where it was, only the general area from which it came. He looked toward Peter's bookcase, and his heart leaped in his chest. Tendrils of smoke were drifting from between the loosely shelved books. Dennis leaped across the room and began pulling books out by double handfuls. He saw that the smoke was issuing from cracks at one side of the bookcase's back. Also, that sound was clearer with the books gone. It was some sort of animal, squeaking in pained distress. Dennis clawed and pawed at the bookcase, his fright spiraling toward panic. If there was one thing people were afraid of in that time and place, it was fire. Soon enough his fingers happened on the secret spring. Flagg had foreseen this, too. After all, the secret panel wasn't really very secret. Enough to amuse a boy, but not much more. The back of the bookcase slid to the right a bit, and a puff of gray smoke wafted out. The smell that escaped with the smoke was extremely unpleasant, a mixture of cooking meat, frying fur, and smoldering paper. Not thinking, Dennis swept the panel all the way open. Of course, when he did that, more air got in. Things which had been only smoldering before now showed the first winks of flame. This was the crucial point, the one place where Flagg had to be content, not with what he was sure would happen, but with his best guess of what would probably happen. All his efforts of the last 75 years now swung upon the fragile hinge of what a butler's son might or might not do in the next 5 seconds. But the Brandons had been butlers since time out of mind, and Flagg had decided he must depend on their long tradition of impeccable behavior. If Dennis had frozen in horror at the sight of those blossoming flames, or if he had turned and run for a pitcher of water, all of Flagg's carefully planted evidence might have burned in greenish-tinted flames. The murder of Peter's father would never have been laid at Peter's door, and he would have been crowned king at noon. But Flagg's judgment was right. Instead of freezing or going for water, Dennis reached in and beat the flames out with his bare hands. It took less than 5 seconds, and Dennis was barely singed. The doleful squeaking went on, and the first thing he saw when he had waved the smoke aside was a mouse lying on its side. It was in its death agonies. It was only a mouse, and Dennis had killed dozens of them in the line of duty without the slightest feeling of pity. Yet he felt sorry for this poor little bugger. Something terrible, something he could not even begin to understand, had happened to it and was still happening to it. Smoke rose from its fur in fine ribbons. When he touched it, he drew his hand back with a hiss. It was like touching the side of a tiny stove, such as the one in Sasha's dollhouse. More smoke drifted lazily from an engraved wooden box with its lid slightly ajar. Dennis lifted the lid a little. He saw the tweezers, the packet. A number of brownish spots had flowered on the packet, and it smoldered sluggishly, but had not burst into flame. Nor did it now. The flames had come from Peter's letters, which were, of course, not enchanted at all. It was the mouse that had set these alight with its fearfully hot body. Now there was only the sullenly smoldering packet, and something warned Dennis not to touch it. He was afraid. There were things here that he didn't understand, things he was not sure he wanted to understand. The one thing he knew for sure was that he badly needed to speak to his father. His father would know what to do. Dennis took the ash bucket and a small shovel from beside the stove and went back to the secret panel. He used the shovel to pick up the smoking body of the mouse and drop it into the ash bucket. He wet the charred corners of the letters once more, just to be sure. Then he closed the panel, replaced the books, and left Peter's apartments. He took the ash bucket with him, and now he did not feel like Peter's loyal servant, but like a thief. His booty was a poor mouse that died even before Dennis got back out the west gate of the castle. And before he had even reached his house on the far side of the castle keep, a horrible suspicion had dawned in his mind. He was the first in Delane to feel this suspicion, but he would not be the last. He tried to push the thought out of his head, but it kept coming back. What sort of poison, Dennis wondered, had killed King Roland anyway? Exactly what sort of poison had it been? By the time he got back to the Brandon house, he was in a bad state indeed, and he would answer none of his mother's questions. Nor would he show her what was in the ash bucket. He told her only that he must see his father the moment he came in. It was dreadfully important. Then he went into his room and wondered exactly what sort of poison it had been. He only knew one thing about it, but that one thing was enough. It had been something hot. Brandon arrived just before 10 o'clock, short-tempered, exhausted, and in no mood for foolishness. He was dirty and sweaty, there was a thin cut across his forehead, and cobwebs flew from his hair in long strings. They had found no sign of the assassin at all. His only news was that preparations for Peter's coronation were going full speed ahead in the Plaza of the Needle, under the direction of Anders Pena, Delane's judge general. His wife told him of Dennis's return. Brandon's brow darkened. He went to the door of his son's room and rapped not with his knuckles but with a closed fist.
"Come out here, boy, and tell us why you come back with the ash bucket from your master's study."
"No," Dennis said.
You come in here, Dad. I don't want Mother to see what I've got, and I don't want her to hear what we say to each other.
Brandon barged in. Dennis's mother waited apprehensively by the stove, expecting it was some sort of semi-hysterical foolishness which the boy had thought up, some ill-advised monkey shine, and that very soon she would hear Dennis's wails as her tired and distraught husband, who must begin today at noon to buttle not a prince but a king, took out all his fears and frustrations on the boy's backside. She hardly blamed Dennis. Everyone in the keep seemed hysterical this morning, running around like crazy people just let out of bedlam, repeating 100 false rumors, then taking them back in order to repeat 100 new ones. But there were no raised voices from behind Dennis's door, and neither of them came out for more than an hour. When they did, a single look at her husband's white face made the poor woman feel like fainting dead away. Dennis scurried along at his father's heels like a scared puppy. Now Brandon was carrying the ash bucket.
"Where are you going?"
she asked timidly. Brandon said nothing. It seemed that Dennis could say nothing. He only rolled his eyes at her and then followed his father out the door. She saw neither of them for 24 hours and became convinced that both were dead, or even worse, that they were suffering in the dungeon of Inquisition below the castle. Her dire thoughts were not so unlikely either, for those were a terrible 24 hours in Dulaine. The day mightn't have seemed so terrible in some places, places where revolt and upheaval and alarms and midnight executions are almost a way of life. There really are such places, although I wish I didn't have to say so. But Dulaine had for years, and even centuries, been an ordered and orderly place, so perhaps they were spoiled. That black day really began when Peter was not crowned at noon and ended with the stunning news that he was to be tried in the Hall of the Needle for the murder of his father. If Dulaine had had a stock market, I suppose it would have crashed. Construction on the dais where the coronation was to take place began at first light. The platform would be a jury-rigged affair of plain boards. Anders Payne knew, but he also knew that enough flowers and bunting would cover the rude spots. They had had no warning of the king's passing, because murder isn't a thing that can be predicted. If it could be, there would be no murders, and the world would almost certainly be a happier place. Besides, pomp and circumstance wasn't the point. The point was to make the people feel the continuity of the throne. If the citizens got the feeling that everything was still all right in spite of the terrible thing that had happened, Pena didn't care how many flower girls got splinters. But at 11 o'clock, construction abruptly ceased. The flower girls were turned away, many of them in tears, by the home guards. At 7 that morning, most of the home guards had begun dressing in their gorgeous red ceremonial uniforms and their tall gray wolf-jaw shakos. They were, of course, to form the ceremonial double line, an aisle down which Peter would walk to be crowned. Then, at 11, they received new orders, strange, unsettling orders. The ceremonial uniforms came off in a blazing hurry, and their dull, dun-colored combat uniforms went on instead. The showy but clumsy ceremonial swords were replaced with the lethal short swords, which were everyday equipment. Impressive but impractical wolf-jaw shakos were cast aside in favor of the squat leather helmets that were normal battle dress. Battle dress. The very term was distressing. Is there such a thing as normal battle dress? I do not think so. Yet soldiers in battle dress were everywhere, their faces stern and forbidding. Prince Peter has committed suicide. That was the most common rumor which went flying about the castle keep. Prince Peter has been murdered. That one ran a close second. Roland was not dead. It was a mistaken diagnosis. The physician has been beheaded, but the old king is insane and no one knows what to do. That was a third. There were many others, some even more foolish. No one slept as darkness stole over the confused, sorrowing castle keep. All the torches in the Plaza of the Needle were lit. The castle blazed with lights, and every house in the keep and on the hills below showed candles and lanterns, as frightened people gathered to talk about the day's events. All agreed wild work was afoot. The night was even longer than the day. Mrs. Brandon kept watch for her men in terrible loneliness. She sat at the window, but for the first time in her life the air was rife with more gossip than she wanted to hear. Yet for all of that, could she stop listening? She could not. As the small hours of the morning stretched out endlessly toward a dawn that she felt would never come, a new rumor began to supplant all the old ones. It was incredible.
unbelievable, and yet it was asserted with more and more assurance until even the guards at their posts were repeating it to one another in undertones. This new rumor terrified Mrs. Brandon most of all because she remembered too well how white poor Dennis's face had been when he had come in with the prince's ash bucket. There had been something inside, something that smelled sick and burnt, something he wouldn't show her. Prince Peter's been taken in custody for the murder of his father. This awful rumor went. He's been taken. Prince Peter's been taken. The prince has murdered his own father. Shortly before dawn, the distracted woman laid her head in her arms and wept. After a bit, her sobbing faded as she fell into a troubled sleep.
Thirty-six. Now tell me what's in that bucket, and be quick about it. We want no fooling, Dennis, do you understand me? Was the first thing Brandon said when he entered Dennis's room and closed the door behind him.
I'll show you, Dad, Dennis said. But first, answer me one question. What sort of poison was it that killed the king?
No one knows.
What were its ways?
Show me what's in the bucket, boy. Do it now.
Brandon balled a great hard fist. He did not shake it. He only held it up. That was enough.
Show me now or be knocked aside.
Brandon looked at the dead mouse for a long time, saying nothing. Dennis watched, scared, as his dad's face grew paler, graver, grayer. The mouse's eyes had burned until they were nothing but charred black cinders. Its brown fur had been crisped black. Smoke still rose from its tiny ears, and its teeth, visible in its death grimace, were a sooty black like the teeth in the grate of a stove. Brandon made as if to touch it and then pulled his hand back. He raised his face to his son and spoke in a hoarse whisper.
"Where did you find this?"
Dennis began to stammer out bundles of phrases which didn't mean a thing. Brandon listened a moment and then squeezed his son's shoulder.
"Draw you a deep breath and put your thoughts all in a row, Denny," he said. "I'm on your side in this, as I am in all else, you know. You did right to keep the sight of this poor thing from your mum. Now tell me how you found it and where you found it."
Eased and reassured, Dennis was able to tell his father the story. His telling was a bit shorter than mine, but it still took several minutes. His father sat in a chair, one knuckle digging into his forehead, shading his eyes. He asked no questions, did not even grunt. When Dennis had finished, his father muttered four words in an undertone, just four words, but they froze the boy's heart into a cold blue cake, or so it felt to him at the time.
"Just like the king."
Brandon's lips were trembling with fright, but he seemed to be trying to smile.
"Do you suppose yonder animal was a king of mice, Denny?"
"Dad. Daddy, I...
"There was a box, you said?"
"Yes."
"And a packet?"
"Yes."
"And the packet was charred, but not burned?"
"Yes."
"And tweezers?"
"Yes. Like Mama uses to pluck the hairs from out in her nose."
"Shh," Brandon said, and dug his knuckle into his forehead again. "Let me think."
5 minutes went by. Brandon sat motionless, almost as if he had gone to sleep, but Dennis knew better. Brandon did not know that Peter's mother had given him the engraved box, or that Peter had lost it when he was small. Both of those things had happened long before Peter entered his half-manhood and Brandon came into his service. He did know about the secret panel. He had happened on this in the very first year he had served Peter, and not very far into that year either. As I may have said, it wasn't really a very secret compartment, as those things went, just enough to satisfy such an open boy as Peter. Brandon knew about it, but had never looked into it after that first time, when it had contained nothing more than the glorified junk that any boy calls his treasures. A tarot deck with a few cards missing, a bag of marbles, a lucky coin, a braided bit of hair from Peony's mane. If a good butler understands anything, he understands that quality we call discretion, which is a respect for the borders of other people's lives. He had never looked in that compartment again. It would have been like stealing. At last, Dennis asked,
"Should we go over, Father, so you can look in the box?"
"No. We must go to the Judge General with this mouse, and you must tell your story to him just as you've told it to me."
Dennis sat down heavily on his bed. He felt as if he had been punched in the belly. Pena, the man who ordered jail terms and beheadings, Pena, with his white, forbidding face and his tall, waxy brow. Pena, who was, below the king himself, the greatest authority in the kingdom.
"No," he whispered at last. "Dad, I couldn't. I...
"You must," his father said sternly. "This is a terrible business, the most terrible business I've ever known of, but it must be reckoned with and set right. You'll tell him just as you've told me, and then it'll be in his hands."
Dennis looked in his father's eyes and saw that Brandon meant it. If he refused to go, his father would lay hold of the scruff of his neck and drag him to Pena like a kitten 20 years old or no. "Yes, Dad," he said miserably, thinking that when Pena's cold, calculating eyes fell on him, he would simply drop dead of a heart attack. Then, with rising panic, he remembered that he had stolen an ash bucket from the prince's rooms. If he didn't die of fright the moment Pena commanded him to speak, he would probably spend the rest of his life in the castle's deepest dungeon for theft.
"Be easy in your mind, Denny, easy as you can be anyway. Pena's a hard man, but he's fair. You've done nothing to be ashamed of. Just tell him as you've told me."
"All right," Dennis whispered. "Are we going now?"
Brandon got out of the chair and onto his knees.
"First we'll pray. Get here beside me, son."
Dennis did. Peter was tried, found guilty of regicide, and ordered imprisoned for life in the cold 2 rooms at the top of the Needle. All of this was done in only 3 days. It will not take long to tell you how neatly the jaws of Flag's cruel trap closed around the boy. Pena did not order the preparations for the coronation stopped at once. In fact, he thought that Dennis must be mistaken, that there must be a reasonable explanation for all of this. Just the same, the condition of the mouse, so like the condition of the king, was impossible to ignore, and the Brandon family had a long and valued reputation for honesty and level-headedness in the kingdom. That was important, but there was something else of far greater importance. When Peter was crowned, there must not be a single stain on his reputation. Pena heard Dennis out and then summoned Peter. Dennis really might have died of fright at the sight of his master, but he was mercifully allowed to go into another room with his father. Pena gravely explained to Peter that a charge had been leveled against him, a charge that Peter himself might have played a part in the murder of Roland. Anders Pena was not a man to mince words, no matter how much those words might hurt. Peter was stunned, flabbergasted. You must remember that he was still trying to cope with the idea that his beloved father was dead, killed by a cruel poison that had burned him alive from the inside out. You must remember that he had been leading the search all night, had had no sleep, and was physically exhausted. Most of all, you must remember that, although he had a man's height and breadth of shoulder, he was only 16. This stunning news, on top of all else, caused him to do a very natural thing, but it was a thing he should have avoided at all costs under Pena's cold and assessing eyes. He burst into tears. If Peter had hotly denied the charge, or if he had expressed his shock and exhaustion and grief by laughing wildly at such an absurd idea, the whole thing might have ended right there. I'm sure that possibility never entered Flagg's mind. But one of Flagg's few weaknesses was a tendency to judge others according to what was in his own black and murky heart. Flagg regarded everyone with suspicion, and believed everyone had hidden reasons for the things they did. His mind was very complex, like a hall of mirrors with everything reflected twice at different sizes. The track of Pena's thoughts was not convoluted, but very straightforward. He found it very difficult, almost impossible, to believe that Peter could have poisoned his father. If he had raged or laughed out loud, things probably would have ended without even a trip to investigate the supposed box with his name carved on it or the packet and tweezers it supposedly held. Tears, however, looked very bad. Tears looked like an expression of guilt coming from a boy old enough to commit murder, but not old enough to hide what he had done. Pena decided he must investigate further. He hated to do this, because it meant taking guards, and that meant some word, some whisper, of these momentary suspicions would leak out to taint the first weeks of Peter's reign. Then he reflected that perhaps even this could be avoided. He would take 6 home guards, no more. He could leave 4 stationed outside the door. After this ridiculous business had blown over, all of them could be shipped off to the remotest part of the kingdom. Brandon and his son would also have to be sent away, Pena thought, and that was a pity. But tongues had a way of wagging, especially when liquor loosened them and the old man's liking for Bundelgen was well known. So Pena ordered work on the coronation platform temporarily suspended. He felt confident that work could begin again in less than half an hour, with the laborers sweating and cursing and hurrying to make up for lost time. Alas! The box, the packet, and the tweezers were there, as you know. Peter had sworn on his mother's name he had no such engraved box. His heated denial now looked very foolish. Pena picked up the charred packet carefully with the tweezers, peered in, and saw three flecks of green sand. They were so small they could barely be seen, but Pena, mindful of what had befallen both Great King and Humble Mouse, put the packet back in the box and closed the lid. He ordered two of the four home guards still in the hall to step in, realizing reluctantly that the matter was steadily growing more serious. The box was put carefully on Peter's desk, little wisps of smoke escaping from it. One of the guards was sent after the man who knew more about poisons than anyone else in the kingdom. That man, of course, was Flag. 39. I had nothing to do with this, Anders, Peter said. He had recovered himself, but his face was still pale and wretched, his eyes a deeper blue than the old Judge General had ever seen them. The box is yours, then? Yes. Why did you deny that you had such a box? I forgot. I haven't seen this box in probably 11 years or more. My mother gave it to me. What happened to it? He's not calling me my lord or your highness any more, Peter thought with a chill. He's not calling me by any term of respect at all. Can all of this really be happening, I wonder? Father poisoned? Thomas terribly ill? Pena standing here and doing everything but accusing me of murder? And my box? Where in the name of the gods did it come from, and who put it in the secret compartment behind the books? I lost it, Peter said slowly. Anders, you don't really believe I murdered my father, do you? I did not. But now I wonder, Anders Pena thought. I loved him dearly, Peter said. I always thought so, but now I wonder about that too, Anders Pena thought. 40. Flag bustled in and, without even looking in Pena's direction, began immediately to bombard the numbed, frightened, outraged prince with questions about the search. Had any trace been found of the poison or the poisoner? Any sign of a plot uncovered? He himself was of the opinion that it might have been a single individual, almost surely insane. He had spent the whole morning before his crystal, Flag said, but the crystal remained stubbornly dark. He didn't care, though. He could do more than shake bones and peer into crystals. He craved action, not spells. Anything the prince wanted him to do, any dark corner he wanted explored. We did not call you here to listen to you babble like your own parrot with both heads talking at once, Pena said coldly. He did not like Flag. As far as Pena was concerned, the magician had been demoted to the position of court nobody at the moment of Roland's death. He might be able to tell them what those evil green flecks in the packet were, but that was the extent of his usefulness. Peter'll have no truck with this weasel when he's crowned, Pena thought. He got just that far, and then his thoughts derailed in dismay, because the chances of Peter's being crowned seemed to be growing slimmer.
No,
Flag said.
I don't suppose you did.
He looked at Peter and said,
Why am I summoned, my king?
Don't call him that!
Pena exploded, deeply shocked in spite of himself. Flag saw this shock on Pena's face, and although he affected to look puzzled, he understood perfectly what it meant and was satisfied. A worm of suspicion was working its way toward the center of the Judge General's chilly heart. Good. Peter turned his pale face away from both of them and looked out across the city, once more struggling for control of his emotions. His fingers were laced tightly together, his knuckles were white. He looked much older than 16 just then. "Do you see the box on the desk?" Pena asked.
"Yes, Judge General."
Flagg said in his stiffest, most formal voice. Inside is a packet which appears to be slowly charring. Inside the packet are what look like grains of sand. I would like you to examine them and see if you can tell me what they are. I urge you very strongly not to touch them. I believe that the substance in the packet may have caused King Roland's death.
Flagg allowed himself to look worried. To tell the truth, he was feeling very fine. Playing a part always made him feel that way. He liked to act. He picked up the packet using the tweezers. He peered into it. His gaze sharpened.
I want a piece of obsidian,
he said.
I want it right now.
I have a piece in my desk, Peter said dully, and brought it out. It was not as big as the one Flagg had used and then disposed of, but it was thick. He handed it to one of the home guards who handed it to Flagg. The magician held it toward the light, frowning a little, but inside his heart a little man was jumping excitedly up and down, turning cartwheels and doing somersaults. The obsidian was much like his own, but one side was broken and jagged. Ah, the gods were smiling on him, indeed, 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 they were. I dropped it a year or two ago, Peter said, seeing Flagg's interest. He was unaware, as was Pena, at least for the moment, that he had added another layer of bricks to the wall that was a building around him. The half your holding landed on my rug, which cushioned its fall. The other half landed on the stones and shattered into 50 pieces. Obsidian is hard, but very brittle.
Indeed, my lord,
Flagg said gravely.
I've never seen such stone, although I've, of course, heard of it.
He put the obsidian on Peter's desk, upended the packet over it, and poured the three grains of sand onto it. In a moment, little tendrils of smoke began to rise from the obsidian. All present could see that each grain was slowly sinking into the pockmark it was creating in the world's hardest known stone. The guards murmured uneasily at the sight.
Be silent!
Pena roared, whirling on them. The guards drew back, faces long and white with terror. This seemed more and more like witchcraft to them.
I believe I know what these grains are, and how to test my idea,
Flagg said, rapping the words out.
But if I'm right, the test must be performed as quickly as possible.
Why? Pena demanded.
I believe these are grains of dragon sand,
Flagg said.
I had a very small quantity once, but it disappeared, alas. Before I could study it closely, it may well have been stolen.
Flagg did not miss the way Pena's eyes flicked toward Peter at this.
I have been uneasy about it off and on ever since,
he went on,
because it is reputed to be one of the deadliest substances on earth. I did not have a chance to test its properties, and so doubted, but I see much of what I was told proved here already.
Flagg pointed at the obsidian. The dimples in which the three specks of green sand rested were each now nearly an inch deep. Smoke rose from each like smoke from a tiny campfire. Flagg guessed that each grain had eaten through half the thickness of the stone.
Those three specks of sand are working their way rapidly through a piece of the hardest rock we know,
he said.
Dragon sand is reputed to be so corrosive that it will eat through any solid at all, and it produces fearsome heat. You, guard.
Flagg pointed at one of the home guards. He stepped forward, not looking happy to have been chosen.
Touch the side of the rock,
Flagg said, and as the guard reached a tentative hand forward to touch the paperweight, he added sharply,
Just the side. Don't get your hand near those holes.
The guard touched the paperweight and drew his hand back with a gasp. He stuck his fingers in his mouth, but not before Pena had seen the blisters rising there.
Obsidian conducts heat very slowly, I've heard,
Flagg said.
But that piece is as hot as the top of a stove, all from 3 grains of sand that would fit on the moon of your pinky fingernail, with room left over. Touch the prince's desk, Lord Judge General.
Pena did. He was distressed and amazed by the heat under his hand. Soon the heavy wood must begin to blister and char.
So we must act quickly,
Flagg said.
Soon the desk itself will catch fire. If we breathe the fumes, always assuming the stories I've been told are true, all of us will die within days. But to be sure, another test.
At this, the home guards looked more uneasy than ever. All right, Pena said. What is this test? Be quick, man! He detested Flagg more than ever now, and if he had ever felt it would not do to underestimate him, he felt that doubly now. 5 minutes before, Pena had been ready to dismiss the man as the court nobody. Now it seemed that their lives, and Pena's case against Peter, depended on him.
I propose to fill a bucket with water,
Flagg said, speaking more rapidly than ever. His dark eyes gleamed. The home guards and Pena stared at those small black holes in the obsidian, at those tiny ribbons of steam, with the evil fascination of birds hypnotized by a nest of weaving pythons. How deep into the obsidian now? How close to the wood? Impossible to tell. Even Peter was looking, although the tired mixture of sorrow and confusion had not left his face.
Water from the prince's pump!
Flagg shouted at one of the guards.
We want it in a bucket or a deep potter pan. Now, now!
The guard looked at Pena.
Do it!
Pena said, trying not to sound frightened, but he was frightened and Flagg knew it. The guard went. In moments they heard water being pumped into a bucket he had found in the butler's cupboard. Flagg was speaking again.
I propose to dip my finger into this bucket. I'll let a drop of water fall into one of those holes,
he said.
We'll watch this closely, Lord Judge General. We must see if the water which goes into the hole turns momentarily green. It's a sure sign.
And then? Pena asked tautly. The home guard returned. Flagg took the bucket, set it on the desk.
Then I'll put drops very carefully into the other two holes,
Flagg said. He spoke calmly, but his normally pallid cheeks were flushed.
Water won't stop dragging the sand, it's told, but it'll hold it.
This was making things quite a bit worse than they were, but Flagg wanted them frightened.
Why not just douse it?
One of the guards blurted. Pena favored this upstart with a horrible glare, but Flagg answered the question calmly as he dipped his pinky finger into the bucket.
Would you like me to wash those 3 grains of sand out of the holes they've made in the rock and somewhere onto the lad's desk?
He asked almost jovially.
We could leave you in here to put out the fire when the water dried up, sirrah.
The guard said no more. Flagg drew his dripping finger out of the bucket.
Water's warm already,
he said to Pena.
Just from sitting on the desk.
He carefully brought his finger, from which a single drop of water hung, over one of the holes.
Watch closely,
Flagg said sharply, and to Peter he sounded at that moment like a cheap peddler about to perform some monstrously deceiving trick. But Pena bent close. The home guards craned their necks. That single drop of water hung from Flagg's finger, for a moment catching all of Peter's room behind it in perfect curved miniature. It hung, elongated, and dropped into the hole. There was a spatting hiss, like the sound of grease dropped onto a hot iron skillet. A tiny geyser of steam arose from the hole, but before it did, Pena clearly saw a cat's eye flash of green. In that moment, Peter's fate was sealed.
Dragon sand by the gods,
Flagg whispered hoarsely.
Don't for pity's sake, breathe that steam.
Anders Pena's courage was as hard as his reputation, but he was afraid now. To him, that single wink of green light had seemed inexpressively evil.
Put out the other two, he said hoarsely. Now!
I told you,
Flagg said, calmly dipping his pinky again and staring at the obsidian.
They can't be put out. Well, there is one way, the tales say, but only one. You wouldn't like it. Yet we can hold them and then get rid of them, I think.
He carefully plinked a drop into each of the other two holes. Each time there was a sullen green flash of light and a plume of steam.
We're all right for a bit, I think,
Flagg said. One of the home guards sighed in gusty relief.
Bring me gloves, or folded cloths. Anything I can use to pick up this rock. It's hot as fury, and those drops of water will be boiled away in no time.
Two hot pads from the butler's closet were brought quickly. Flagg used them to grasp the obsidian. He lifted it, careful to keep it level, then dropped it into the bucket. As the obsidian sank to the bottom, all of them clearly saw the water turn a momentary light green.
Now,
Flagg said expansively.
That is well. One of these guards must take this bucket out of the castle, and to the large pump by the great old tree in the middle of the keep. There you must draw a large basin of water, and put the bucket in the basin. The basin must be taken to the middle of Lake Johanna, and sunk in the middle. The dragon sand may heat up the lake in 100,000 years. But let those that come in that time, if any do, worry about that, I say.
Pena paused for just a moment, biting his lip in uncharacteristic indecision, and then he said,
You and you and you, do as he says.
The bucket was removed. The home guards carried it like men carrying a live bomb. Flagg was amused, for all of this was, in large part, magician's foolery, as Peter himself had momentarily suspected. The single drops of water he had allowed to fall into the holes had not been enough to stop the corrosive effect of the sand, at least not for long, but he knew that the water in the bucket would damp it well. Even less liquid would have served for more of the sand, a goblet of wine, say? But let them believe what they would, in time they would turn against Peter with that much more fury. When the guards had gone, Pena turned to Flagg.
You said there was one way the effect of dragon sand could be neutralized?
Yes. The stories say that if it is taken into a living being, that living being will burn in agony until it is dead. And when it is over, the dying, the power of the dragon sand also dies. I had meant to test it, but before I could do it, my sample disappeared.
Pena was staring at him, white around the lips.
And on what sort of living being did you intend to test this damned stuff, magician?
Flagg looked at Pena with bland innocence.
Why, on a mouse. My Lord Judge General, of course.
At 3 that afternoon, a strange meeting took place in the royal court of Delane at the base of the Needle, a great room which, over the years, had become known simply as Pena's Court. Meeting. I don't like that word. It's too tame and small to describe the momentous decision that was arrived at that afternoon. I cannot call it a hearing or a trial, because that gathering had no legal meaning at all, but it was very important, as I think you will agree. The room was large enough to hold 500, but there were only 7 there that afternoon. 6 of them huddled close together, as if it made them nervous to be so few in a place meant for so many. The royal arms of the kingdom, a unicorn spearing a dragon, hung on one of the circular stone walls, and Peter found his gaze returning to this again and again. Besides himself, Pena was there, and Flagg. It was Flagg, of course, who sat slightly apart from the others, and 4 of the kingdom's great lawyers. There were 10 great lawyers in all, but the other 6 were at various far-flung places in Delane hearing cases. Pena had decided he couldn't wait for them. He knew he had to move fast and decisively or the kingdom might bleed. He knew it, but it galled him to know he would need the help of this cool young murderer to avert such bloodshed. That Peter was a murderer was something Anders Pena had now decided in his own heart. It wasn't the box, the green sand, or even the burning mouth that had decided him. It was Peter's tears. Peter, to do him credit, looked neither guilty nor weak now. He was pale but calm, completely in charge of himself again. Pena cleared his throat. The sound echoed dully back from the forbidding stone walls of the court chamber. He pressed a hand to his forehead and was not entirely surprised to find a sheen of cold sweat there. He had heard testimony in hundreds of great and solemn cases. He had sent more men than he cared to remember beneath the headsman's axe, but never had he thought he would have to attend a meeting such as this, or the trial of a prince for the murder of his royal father. And such a trial would surely follow if all went as he hoped this afternoon. It was right, he thought, that he be sweating, and right that the sweat should be cold. Just a meeting. Nothing legal here, nothing official, nothing of the kingdom, but none of them. Not Pena, not Flag, not the great lawyers, not Peter himself. Were fooled. This was the real trial, this meeting. The power was here. That burning mouse had set a great course of events in motion. That course would either be turned here, as a great river may be turned near its source when it is still a brook, or it would be allowed to run onward, gathering power as it went, until no force on earth could turn it or stand before it. Just a meeting, Anders Pena thought, and wiped more sweat from his forehead. 42. Flag watched the proceedings with a lively eye. Like Pena, he knew that all would be decided here, and he felt confident. Peter's head was up, his gaze firm. He met the eyes of each member of this informal jury in turn. The stone walls frowned down on all 7. The spectators' benches were empty, but Pena seemed to feel the weight of phantom eyes, eyes that demanded justice be rendered in this terrible matter. "My lord," Pena said at last, "the sun made you king 3 hours ago." Peter looked at Pena, surprised but silent. "Yes," Pena said, as if Peter had spoken. The great lawyers were nodding, and they looked dreadfully solemn. "There has been no coronation, but a coronation is only a public event. It is, for all its solemnity, show and not substance. God, the law, and the sun make a king, not the coronation. You are king at this very minute, legally able to command me, all of us here, the entire kingdom. This puts us in a terrible dilemma. Do you understand what it is?"
"Yes," Peter said gravely. "You think your king is a murderer." Pena was a little surprised by this bluntness, but not entirely unhappy with it. Peter had always been a blunt boy. It was a pity that his surface bluntness had concealed such depths of calculation. But the important thing was that such bluntness, probably the result of a boy's stupid bravado, would speed things up. "What we believe, my lord, doesn't matter. Guilt or innocence is for a court to determine. So I've always been taught, so I believe with my most sincere heart. There is only one exception to this. Kings are above the law. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"But," Pena raised his finger, "but this crime was committed before you were king. So far as I know, this terrible situation has never come before a court of Delane before. The possibilities are terrible. Anarchy, chaos, civil war. To avert all of these things, my lord, we must have your help."
Peter looked at him gravely. "I will help if I can," he said. "And I think, I pray, you will agree to what I am about to propose," Pena thought. He was conscious of fresh sweat on his forehead, but he didn't wipe it off this time. Peter was only a boy, but he was a bright boy. He might take it as a sign of weakness. "You'll say you're agreeing for the good of the kingdom. But a boy who could have the monstrous, twisted courage to kill his own father is also, I hope, a boy who cannot help believing he will get away with it.
You believe we will help you cover this up, but oh, my lord, you are so wrong. Flagg, who could almost read these thoughts, raised his hand to his mouth to cover a smile. Pena hated him, but Pena had become his number one helper without even knowing it.
I want you to put aside the crown.